everywhere, for everyone who is of our age, to some more, and to others less. It is the common fate of our generation. Albert expresses it. The war has ruined us for everything. He is right. We are not youth any longer. We don't want to take the world by storm. We are fleeing. We fly from ourselves, from our life. We were 18 and had begun to love life and the world, and we had to shoot it to pieces. The first bomb, the first explosion, burst in our hearts. We are cut off from activity, from striving, from progress. We believe in such things no longer. We believe in the war. The orderly room shows signs of life. Himmelstoss seems to have stirred them up. At the head of the column trots the fat sergeant major. It is queer that almost all of the regular sergeant majors are fat. Himmelstoss follows him, thirsting for vengeance. His boots gleam in the sun. We get up. "Where's Jaden?" the sergeant puffs. No one knows, of course. Himmelstoss glowers at us wrathfully. "You know very well. You won't say that's the fact of the matter. Out with it." Fatty looks round inquiringly, but Jaden is not to be seen. He tries another way. "Jaden will report at the orderly room in 10 minutes. Then he steams off with Himmelstoss in his wake. I have a feeling that next time we go up wiring, I'll be letting a bundle of wire fall on Himmelstoss's leg, hints Grop. "We'll have quite a lot of jokes with him," laughs Müller. That is our sole ambition, to knock the conceit out of a postman. I go into the hut and put Jaden wise. He disappears. Then we change our posse and lie down again to play cards. We know how to do that, to play cards, to swear, and to fight. Not much for 20 years, and yet too much for 20 years. Half an hour later, Himmelstoss is back again. Nobody pays any attention to him. He asks for Jaden. We shrug our shoulders. "Then you'd better find him," he persists. "Haven't you been to look for him?" Krupp lies back on the grass and says, "Have you ever been out here before?" "That's none of your business," retorts Himmelstoss. "I expect an answer." "Very good," says Krupp, getting up. "See up there where those little white clouds are? Those are anti-aircraft. We were over there yesterday, 5 dead and 8 wounded. And that's a mere nothing. Next time, when you go up with us, before they die, the fellows will come up to you, click their heels, and ask stiffly, 'Please, may I go? Please, may I hop it? We've been waiting here a long time for someone like you.'" He sits down again, and Himmelstoss disappears like a comet. 3 days CB, conjectures Cat. "Next time I'll let fly," I say to Albert. But that is the end. The case comes up for trial in the evening. In the orderly room sits our lieutenant, Bertink, and calls us in, one after another. I have to appear as a witness and explain the reason of Tjaden's insubordination. The story of the bedwetting makes an impression. Himmelstoss is recalled, and I repeat my statement. "Is that right?" Bertink asks Himmelstoss. He tries to evade the question, but in the end has to confess, for Krupp tells the same story. "Why didn't someone report the matter then?" asks Bertink. We are silent. He must know himself how much use it is in reporting such things. It isn't usual to make complaints in the army. He understands it all right, though, and lectures Himmelstoss, making it plain to him that the front isn't a parade ground. Then comes Chaden's turn. He gets a long sermon and 3 days open arrest. Bertink gives Krupp a wink and 1 day's open arrest. "It can't be helped," he says to him regretfully. He is a decent fellow. Open arrest is quite pleasant. The Clink was once a fowl house. There we can visit the prisoners. We know how to manage it. Close arrest would have meant the cellar. They used to tie us to a tree, but that is forbidden now. In many ways, we are treated quite like men. An hour later, after Tjaden and Krop are settled in behind their wire netting, we make our way into them. Tjaden greets us crowing. Then we play scat far into the night. Tjaden wins, of course, the lucky wretch. When we break it up, Kat says to me, "What do you say to some roast goose?" "Not bad," I agree. We climb up on a munition wagon. The ride costs us 2 cigarettes. Kat has marked the spot exactly. The shed belongs to a regimental headquarters. I agree to get the goose and receive my instructions. The outhouse is behind the wall, and the door shuts with just a peg. Kat hoists me up. I rest my foot in his hands and climb over the wall. Kat keeps watch below. I wait a few moments to accustom my eyes to the darkness. Then I recognize the shed. Softly I steal across, lift the peg, pull it out, and open the door. I distinguish 2 white patches. 2 geese. That's bad. If I grab one, the other will cackle. Well, both of them. If I'm quick, it can be done. I make a jump. I catch hold of one, and the next instant, the second. Like a madman, I bash their heads against the wall to stun them, but I haven't quite enough weight. The beasts cackle and strike out with their feet and wings. I fight desperately, but Lord, what a kick a goose has. They struggle, and I stagger about. In the dark, these white patches are terrifying. My arms have grown wings, and I'm almost afraid of going up into the sky as though I held a couple of captive balloons in my fists. Then the row begins. One of them gets his breath and goes off like an alarm clock. Before I can do anything, something comes in from outside. I feel a blow, lie outstretched on the floor, and hear awful growls. A dog. I steal a glance to the side. He makes a snap at my throat. I lie still and tuck my chin into my collar. It's a bulldog. After an eternity, he withdraws his head and sits down beside me. But if I make the least movement, he growls. I consider. The only thing to do is to get hold of my small revolver, and that, too, before anyone arrives. Inch by inch, I move my hand toward it. I have the feeling that it lasts an hour. The slightest movement, and then an awful growl. I lie still, then try again. When at last I have the revolver, my hand starts to tremble. I press it against the ground and say over to myself, jerk the revolver up, fire before he has a chance to grab, and then jump up. Slowly I take a deep breath and become calmer. Then I hold my breath, whip up the revolver, it cracks, the dog leaps howling to one side, I make for the door of the shed and fall head over heels over one of the scuttering geese. At full speed I seize it again and with a swing toss it over the wall and clamber up. No sooner am I on top than the dog is up again, as lively as ever, and springs at me. Quickly I let myself drop. 10 paces away stands Cat with the goose under his arm. As soon as he sees me, we run. At last we can take a breather. The goose is dead, Cat saw to that in a moment. We intend to roast it at once so that nobody will be any wiser. I fetch a Dixie and wood from the hut, and we crawl into a small, deserted lean-to which we use for such purposes. The single window space is heavily curtained. There is a sort of hearth, an iron plate set on some bricks. We kindle a fire. Cat plucks and cleans the goose. We put the feathers carefully to one side. We intend to make 2 cushions out of them with the inscription, "Sleep soft under shell fire." The sound of the gunfire from the front penetrates into our refuge. The glow of the fire lights up our faces. Shadows dance on the wall. Sometimes a heavy crash, and the lean-to shivers. Aeroplane bombs. Once we hear a stifled cry, a hut must have been hit. Aeroplanes drone. The tack-tack of machine guns breaks out. But no light that could be observed shows from us. We sit opposite one another, Cat and I, 2 soldiers in shabby coats, cooking a goose in the middle of the night. We don't talk much, but I believe we have a more complete communion with one another than even lovers have. We are 2 men, 2 minute sparks of life. Outside is the night and the circle of death. We sit on the edge of it, crouching in danger, the grease strips from our hands. In our hearts we are close to one another, and the hour is like the room. flecked over with the lights and shadows of our feelings cast by a quiet fire. What does he know of me, or I of him? Formerly we should not have had a single thought in common. Now we sit with a goose between us and feel in unison, are so intimate that we do not even speak. It takes a long time to roast a goose, even when it is young and fat. So we take turns. One bastes it while the other lies down and sleeps. A grand smell gradually fills the hut. The noises without increase in volume, pass into my dream and yet linger in my memory. In a half-sleep I watch Cat dip and raise the ladle. I love him, his shoulders, his angular, stooping figure, and at the same time I see behind him woods and stars, and a clear voice utters words that bring me peace. To me, a soldier in big boots, belt, and knapsack, taking the road that lies before him under the high heaven, quickly forgetting and seldom sorrowful, forever pressing on under the wide night sky. A little soldier and a clear voice, and if anyone were to caress him, he would hardly understand, this soldier with the big boots and the shut heart, who marches because he is wearing big boots and has forgotten all else but marching. Beyond the skyline is a country with flowers, lying so still that he would like to weep. There are sights there that he has not forgotten, because he never possessed them, perplexing yet lost to him. Are not his 20 summers there? Is my face wet? And where am I? Cat stands before me, his gigantic stooping shadow falls upon me like home. He speaks gently, he smiles and goes back to the fire. Then he says, "It's done." "Yes, Cat." I stir myself. In the middle of the room shines the brown goose. We take out our collapsible forks and our pocket knives, and each cuts off a leg. With it we have army bread dipped in gravy. We eat slowly and with gusto. "How does it taste, Cat?" "Good. And yours?" "Good, Cat." We are brothers and press on one another the choicest pieces. Afterwards I smoke a cigarette and Cat a cigar. There is still a lot left. "How would it be, Cat, if we took a bit to Krop and Tjaden?" "Sure," says he. We carve off a portion and wrap it up carefully in newspaper. The rest we thought of taking over to the hut. Cat laughs and simply says, "Tjaden." I agree, we will have to take it all. So we go off to the fowl house to waken them. But first we pack away the feathers. Krop and Tjaden take us for magicians. Then they get busy with their teeth. Tjaden holds a wing in his mouth with both hands like a mouth organ and gnaws. He drinks the gravy from the pot and smacks his lips. "May I never forget you." We go to our hut. Again there is the lofty sky with the stars and the oncoming dawn, and I pass beneath it, a soldier with big boots and a full belly, a little soldier in the early morning. But by my side, stooping and angular, goes Cat, my comrade. The outlines of the huts are upon us in the dawn, like a dark, deep sleep. Chapter 6. There are rumors of an offensive. We go up to the front 2 days earlier than usual. On the way we pass a shelled schoolhouse. Stacked up against its longer side is a high double wall of yellow, unpolished, brand new coffins. They still smell of resin and pine and the forest. There are at least 100. "That's a good preparation for the offensive," says Müller, astonished. "They're for us," growls Dietering. "Don't talk rot," says Cat to him angrily. "You be thankful if you get so much as a coffin," grins Tjaden. "They'll slip you a waterproof sheet for your old Aunt Sally of a carcass." The others jest too, unpleasant jests, but what else can a man do? The coffins are really for us. The organization surpasses itself in that kind of thing. Ahead of us everything is shimmering. The first night we try to get our bearings. When it is fairly quiet, we can hear the transports behind the enemy lines rolling ceaselessly until dawn. Kat says that they do not go back, but are bringing up troops, munitions, and guns. The English artillery has been strengthened. That we can detect at once. There are at least four more batteries of 9-inch guns to the right of the farm, and behind the poplars they have put in trench mortars. Besides these, they have brought up a number of those little French beasts with instantaneous fuses. We are now in low spirits. After we have been in the dugouts 2 hours, our own shells begin to fall in the trench. This is the third time in 4 weeks. If it were simply a mistake in aim, no one would say anything, but the truth is that the barrels are worn out. The shots are often so uncertain that they land within our own lines. Tonight, 2 of our men were wounded by them. The front is a cage in which we must await fearfully whatever may happen. We lie under the network of arching shells and live in a suspense of uncertainty. Over us, chance hovers. If a shot comes, we can duck. That is all. We neither know nor can determine where it will fall. It is this chance that makes us indifferent. A few months ago, I was sitting in a dugout playing scat. After a while, I stood up and went to visit some friends in another dugout. On my return, nothing more was to be seen of the first one. It had been blown to pieces by a direct. I went back to the second and arrived just in time to lend a hand digging it out. In the interval, it had been buried. It is just as much a matter of chance that I am still alive as that I might have been. In a bomb-proof dugout, I may be smashed to atoms, and in the open may survive 10 hours bombardment unscathed. No soldier outlives 1,000 chances. But every soldier believes in chance and trusts his luck. We must look out for our bread. The rats have become much more numerous lately, because the trenches are no longer in good condition. Datering says it is a sure sign of a coming bombardment. The rats here are particularly repulsive. They are so fat, the kind we all call corpse rats. They have shocking, evil, naked faces, and it is nauseating to see their long, nude tail. They seem to be mighty hungry. Almost every man has had his bread gnawed. Krupp wrapped his in his waterproof sheet and put it under his head. He cannot sleep because they run over his face to get at him. Catering men to outwit them, fastened a thin wire to the roof and suspended his bread from it. During the night, when he switched on his pocket torch, he saw the wire swing to and fro. On the bread was riding a fat rat. At last we put a stop to it. We cannot afford to throw the bread away, because then we should have nothing left to eat in the morning. So we carefully cut off the bits of bread that the animals have gnawed. The slices we cut off are heaped together in the middle of the floor. Each man takes out his spade and lies down, prepared to strike. Datering, Krupp, and Kat hold their pocket torches ready. After a few minutes we hear the first shuffling and tugging. It grows. Now it is the sound of many little feet. Then the torches switch on, and every man strikes at the heap, which scatters with a rush. The result is good. We toss the bits of rat over the parapet, and again lie in wait. Several times we repeat the process. At last the beasts get wise to it, or perhaps they have scented the blood. They return no more. Nevertheless, before morning, the remainder of the bread on the floor has been carried off. In the adjoining sector, they attacked 2 large cats and a dog, bit them to death, and devoured them. Next day, there was an issue of Edamer cheese. Each man gets almost 1/4 of a cheese. In one way, that is all to the good, for Edamer is tasty. But in another way, it is vile, because the fat red balls have long been a sign of a bad time coming. Our forebodings increase as rum is served out. We drink it, of course, but are not greatly comforted. During the day we loaf about and make war on the rats. Ammunition and hand grenades become more plentiful. We overhaul the bayonets, that is to say, the ones that have a saw on the blunt edge. If the fellows over there catch a man with one of those, he's killed at sight. In the next sector, some of our men were found whose noses were cut off, and their eyes poked out with their own saw bayonets. Their mouths and noses were stuffed with sawdust so that they suffocated. Some of the recruits have bayonets of this sort. We take them away and give them the ordinary kind. But the bayonet has practically lost its importance. It is usually the fashion now to charge with bombs and spades only. The sharpened spade is a more handy and many-sided weapon. Not only can it be used for jabbing a man under the chin, but it is much better for striking with because of its greater weight, and if one hits between the neck and shoulder, it easily cleaves as far down as the chest. The bayonet frequently jams on the thrust, and then a man has to kick hard on the other fellow's belly to pull it out again, and in the interval he may easily get one himself. And what's more, the blade often gets broken off. At night they send over gas. We expect the attack to follow and lie with our masks on, ready to tear them off as soon as the first shadow appears. Dawn approaches without anything happening. Only the everlasting, nerve-wracking roll behind the enemy lines. Trains, trains, lorries, lorries. But what are they concentrating? Our artillery fires on it continually, but still it does not cease. We have tired faces and avoid each other's eyes. "It will be like the Somme," says Cat gloomily. "There we were shelled steadily for 7 days and nights." Cat has lost all his fun since we've been here, which is bad, for Cat is an old front hog and can smell what is coming. Only Tjaden seems pleased with the good rations and the rum. He thinks we might even go back to rest without anything happening at all. It almost looks like it. Day after day passes. At night I squat in the listening post. Above me the rockets and parachute lights shoot up and float down again. I am cautious and tense. My heart thumps. My eyes turn again and again to the luminous dial of my watch. The hands will not budge. Sleep hangs on my eyelids. I work my toes in my boots in order to keep awake. Nothing happens till I am relieved. Only the everlasting rolling over there. Gradually we grow calmer and play scat and poker continually. Perhaps we will be lucky. All day the sky is hung with observation balloons. There is a rumor that the enemy are going to put tanks over and use low-flying planes for the attack. But that interests us less than what we hear of the new flamethrowers. We wake up in the middle of the night. The earth booms. Heavy fire is falling on us. We crouch into corners. We distinguish shells of every caliber. Each man lays hold of his things and looks again every minute to reassure himself that they are still there. The dugout heaves. The night roars and flashes. We look at each other in the momentary flashes of light and with pale faces and pressed lips shake our heads. Every man is aware of the heavy shells tearing down the parapet, rooting up the embankment, and demolishing the upper layers of concrete. When a shell lands in the trench, we note how the hollow, furious blast is like a blow from the paw of a raging beast of prey. Already by morning, a few of the recruits are green and vomiting. They are too inexperienced. Slowly the gray light trickles into the post and pales the flashes of the shells. Morning has come. The explosion of mines mingles with the gunfire. That is the most dementing convulsion of all. The whole region where they go up becomes one grave. The reliefs go out. The observers stagger in, covered with dirt and trembling. One lies down in silence in the corner and eats. The other, an older man of the new draft, sobs. Twice he has been flung over the parapet by the blast of the explosions without getting any more than shell shock. The recruits are eyeing him. We must watch them. These things are catching. Already some lips begin to quiver. It is good that it is growing daylight. Perhaps the attack will come before noon. The bombardment does not diminish. It is falling in the rear, too. As far as one can see, spout fountains of mud and iron. A wide belt is being raked. The attack does not come, but the bombardment continues. We are gradually benumbed. Hardly a man speaks. We cannot make ourselves understood. Our trench is almost gone. At many places it is only 18 inches high. It is broken by holes and craters and mountains of earth. A shell lands square in front of our post. At once it is dark. We are buried and must dig ourselves out. After an hour, the entrance is clear again, and we are calmer because we have had something to do. Our company commander scrambles in and reports that two dugouts are gone. The recruits calm themselves when they see him. He says that an attempt will be made to bring up food this evening. That sounds reassuring. No one had thought of it except Tjaden. Now the outside world seems to draw a little nearer. If food can be brought up, think the recruits, then it can't really be so bad. We do not disabuse them. We know that food is as important as ammunition, and only for that reason must be brought up. But it miscarries. A second party goes out, and it also turns back. Finally, Cat tries, and even he reappears without accomplishing anything. No one gets through. Not even a fly is small enough to get through such a barrage. We pull in our belts tighter and chew every mouthful three times as long. Still, the food does not last out. We're damnably hungry. I take out a scrap of bread, eat the white, and put the crust back in my knapsack. From time to time, I nibble at it. The night is unbearable. We cannot sleep, but stare ahead of us and doze. Tjaden regrets that we wasted the gnawed pieces of bread on the rats. We would gladly have them again to eat now. We are short of water, too, but not seriously yet. Towards morning, while it is still dark, there is some excitement. Through the entrance rushes in a swarm of fleeing rats that try to storm the walls. Torches light up the confusion. Everyone yells and curses and slaughters. The madness and despair of many hours unloads itself in this outburst. Faces are distorted, arms strike out, and the beasts scream. We just stop in time to avoid attacking one another. The onslaught has exhausted us. We lie down to wait again. It is a marvel that our post has had no casualties so far. It is one of the less deep dugouts. A corporal creeps in. He has a loaf of bread with him. Three people have had the luck to get through during the night and bring some provisions. They say the bombardment extends undiminished as far as the artillery lines. It is a mystery where the enemy gets all his shells. We wait and wait. By midday, what I expected happens. One of the recruits has a fit. I've been watching him for a long time, grinding his teeth and opening and shutting his fists. These hunted, protruding eyes, we know them too well. During the last few hours, he has had merely the appearance of calm. He had collapsed like a rotten tree. Now he stands up, stealthily creeps across the floor, hesitates a moment, and then glides towards the door. I intercept him and say, "Where are you going?" "I'll be back in a minute," says he, and tries to push past me. "Wait a bit. The shelling will stop soon." He listens for a moment, and his eyes become clear. Then again he has the glowering eyes of a mad dog. He is silent. He shoves me aside. "One minute, lad," I say. Cat notices. Just as the recruit shakes me off, Cat jumps in, and we hold him. Then he begins to rave. "Leave me alone! Let me go out! I will go out!" He won't listen to anything and hits out. His mouth is wet and pours out words, half-choked, meaningless words. It is a case of claustrophobia. He feels as though he is suffocating here and wants to get out at any price. If we let him go, he would run about everywhere regardless of cover. He is not the first. Though he raves and his eyes roll, it can't be helped. We have to give him a hiding to bring him to his senses. We do it quickly and mercilessly. And at last he sits down quietly. The others have turned pale. Let's hope it deters them. This bombardment is too much for the poor devils. They have been sent straight from a recruiting depot into a barrage that is enough to turn an old soldier's hair gray. After this affair, the sticky, close atmosphere works more than ever on our nerves. We sit as if in our graves, waiting only to be closed in. Suddenly it howls and flashes terrifically. The dugout cracks in all its joints under a direct hit. Fortunately, only a light one that the concrete blocks are able to withstand. It rings metallically. The walls reel. Rifles, helmets, earth, mud, and dust fly everywhere. Sulfur fumes pour in. If we were in one of those light dugouts that they have been building lately, instead of this deeper one, none of us would be alive. But the effect is bad enough even so. The recruit starts to rave again, and two others follow suit. One jumps up and rushes out. We have trouble with the other two. I start after one who escapes and wonder whether to shoot him in the leg. Then it shrieks again. I fling myself down, and when I stand up, the wall of the trench is plastered with smoking splinters, lumps of flesh, and bits of uniform. I scramble back. The first recruit seems actually to have gone insane. He butts his head against the wall like a goat. We must try tonight to take him to the rear. Meanwhile, we bind him, but in such a way that in case of attack he can be released at once. Cat suggests a game of scat. It is easier when a man has something to do. But it is no use. We listen for every explosion that comes close, miscount the tricks, and fail to follow suit. We have to give it up. We sit as though in a boiler that is being belabored from without on all sides. Night again. We are deadened by the strain, a deadly tension that scrapes along one's spine like a gapped knife. Our legs refuse to move, our hands tremble, our bodies are a thin skin stretched painfully over repressed madness, over an almost irresistible bursting roar. We have neither flesh nor muscles any longer. We dare not look at one another for fear of some miscalculable thing, so we shut our teeth. It will end. It will end. Perhaps we will come through. Suddenly the nearer explosions cease. The shelling continues, but it has lifted and falls behind us. Our trench is free. We seize the hand grenades, pitch them out in front of the dugout, and jump after them. The bombardment has stopped, and a heavy barrage now falls behind us. The attack has come. No one would believe that in this howling waste there could still be men, but steel helmets now appear on all sides out of the trench, and 50 yards from us a machine gun is already in position and barking. The wire entanglements are torn to pieces, yet they offer some obstacle. We see the storm troops coming. Our artillery opens fire. Machine guns rattle, rifles crack. The charge works its way across. Haya and Krop begin with the hand grenades. They throw as fast as they can. Others pass them, the handles with the strings already pulled. Haya throws 75 yards, Krop 60. It has been measured. The distance is important. The enemy, as they run, cannot do much before they are within 40 yards. We recognize the smooth, distorted faces, the helmets. They are French. They have already suffered heavily when they reach the remnants of the barbed wire entanglements. A whole line has gone down before our machine guns. Then we have a lot of stoppages, and they come nearer. I see one of them, his face upturned, fall into a wire cradle. His body collapses. His hands remain suspended as though he were praying. Then his body drops clean away, and only his hands, with the stumps of his arms shot off, now hang in the wire. The moment we are about to retreat, three faces rise up from the ground in front of us. Under one of the helmets, a dark, pointed beard and two eyes that are fastened on me. I raise my hand, but I cannot throw into those strange eyes. For one mad moment, the whole slaughter whirls like a circus around me, and these two eyes alone are motionless. Then the head rises up, a hand, a movement, and my hand grenade flies through the air and into him. We make for the rear, pull wire cradles into the trench, and leave bombs behind us with the strings pulled, which ensures us a fiery retreat. The machine guns are already firing from the next position. We have become wild beasts. We do not fight, we defend ourselves against annihilation. It is not against men that we fling our bombs. What do we know of men in this moment, when death is hunting us down? Now, for the first time in 3 days, we can see his face. Now, for the first time in 3 days, we can oppose him. We feel a mad anger. No longer do we lie helpless, waiting on the scaffold. We can destroy and kill to save ourselves and to be revenged. We crouch behind every corner, behind every barrier of barbed wire, and hurl heaps of explosives at the feet of the advancing enemy before we run. The blast of the hand grenades impinges powerfully on our arms and legs. Crouching like cats, we run on, overwhelmed by this wave that bears us along, that fills us with ferocity, turns us into thugs, into murderers, into God only knows what devils. This wave that multiplies our strength with fear and madness and greed of life, seeking and fighting for nothing but our deliverance. If your own father came over with them, you would not hesitate to fling a bomb at him. The forward trenches have been abandoned. Are they still trenches? They are blown to pieces, annihilated. There are only broken bits of trenches, holes linked by cracks, nests of craters, that is all. But the enemy's casualties increase. They did not count on so much resistance. It is nearly noon. The sun blazes hotly. The sweat stings in our eyes. We wipe it off on our sleeves and often blood with it. At last we reach a trench that is in a somewhat better condition. It is manned and ready for the counterattack. It receives us. Our guns open in full blast and cut off the enemy attack. The lines behind us stop. They can advance no farther. The attack is crushed by our artillery. We watch. The fire lifts 100 yards and we break forward. Beside me, a lance corporal has his head torn off. He runs a few steps more, while the blood spouts from his neck like a fountain. It does not come quite to hand-to-hand fighting. They are driven back. We arrive once again at our shattered trench and pass on beyond it. Oh, this turning back again. We reach the shelter of the reserves and yearn to creep in and disappear, but instead we must turn round and plunge again into the horror. If we were not automata at that moment, we would continue lying there, exhausted and without will. But we are swept forward again, powerless, madly savage and raging. We will kill, for they are still our mortal enemies. Their rifles and bombs are aimed against us, and if we don't destroy them, they will destroy us. The brown earth, the torn, blasted earth, with a greasy shine under the sun's rays. The earth is the background of this restless, gloomy world of automatons. Our gasping is the scratching of a quill. Our lips are dry. Our heads are debauched with stupor. Thus we stagger forward, and into our pierced and shattered souls bores the torturing image of the brown earth with the greasy sun and the convulsed and dead soldiers who lie there. It can't be helped. Who cry and clutch at our legs as we spring away over them. We have lost all feeling for one another. We can hardly control ourselves when our glance lights on the form of some other man. We are insensible, dead men who, through some trick, some dreadful magic, are still able to run and to kill. A young Frenchman lags behind. He is overtaken. He puts up his hands. In one he still holds his revolver. Does he mean to shoot or to give himself? A blow from a spade cleaves through his face. A second sees it and tries to run farther. A bayonet jabs into his back. He leaps in the air, his arms thrown wide, his mouth wide open, yelling. He staggers. In his back, the bayonet quivers. A third throws away his rifle, cowers down with his hands before his eyes. He is left behind with a few other prisoners to carry off the wounded. Suddenly, in the pursuit, we reach the enemy line. We are so close on the heels of our retreating enemies that we reach it almost at the same time as they. In this way, we suffer few casualties. A machine gun barks but is silenced with a bomb. Nevertheless, the couple of seconds has sufficed to give us 5 stomach wounds. With the butt of his rifle, Cat smashes to pulp the face of one of the unwounded machine gunners. We bayonet the others before they have time to get out their bombs. Then thirstily we drink the water they have for cooling the gun. Everywhere wire cutters are snapping, planks are thrown across the entanglements. We jump through the narrow entrances into the trenches. Haya strikes his spade into the neck of a gigantic Frenchman and throws the first hand grenade. We duck behind a breastwork for a few seconds. Then the straight bit of trench ahead of us is empty. The next throw whizzes obliquely over the corner and clears a passage. As we run past, we toss handfuls down into the dugouts. The earth shudders. It crashes, smokes, and groans. We stumble over slippery lumps of flesh, over yielding bodies. I fall into an open belly on which lies a clean new officer's cap. The fight ceases. We lose touch with the enemy. We cannot stay here long, but must retire under cover of our artillery to our own position. No sooner do we know this than we dive into the nearest dugouts and with the utmost haste seize on whatever provisions we can see, especially the tins of corned beef and butter, before we clear out. We get back pretty well. There is no further attack by the enemy. We lie for an hour, panting and resting, before anyone speaks. We are so completely played out that in spite of our great hunger, we do not think of the provisions. Then gradually, we become something like men again. The corned beef over there is famous along the whole front. Occasionally, it has been the chief reason for a flying raid on our part, for our nourishment is generally very bad. We have a constant hunger. We bagged 5 tins altogether. The fellows over there are well looked after. They fare magnificently, as against us, poor starving wretches with our turnip jam. They can get all the meat they want. Haya has scored a thin loaf of white French bread and stuck it behind his belt like a spade. It is a bit bloody at one corner, but that can be cut off. It is a good thing we have something decent to eat at last. We still have a use for all our strength. Enough to eat is just as valuable as a good dugout. It can save our lives. That is the reason we are so greedy for it. Tjaden has captured 2 water bottles full of cognac. We pass them round. The evening benediction begins. Night comes. Out of the craters rise the mists. It looks as though the holes were full of ghostly secrets. The white vapor creeps painfully round before it ventures to steal away over the edge. Then long streaks stretch from crater to crater. It is chilly. I am on sentry and stare into the darkness. My strength is exhausted, as always, after an attack, and so it is hard for me to be alone with my thoughts. They are not properly thoughts. They are memories which in my weakness haunt me and strangely move me. The parachute lights soar upwards, and I see a picture, a summer evening. I am in the cathedral cloister, and look at the tall rose trees that bloom in the middle of the little cloister garden where the monks lie buried. Around the walls are the stone carvings of the Stations of the Cross. No one is there. A great quietness rules in this blossoming quadrangle. The sun lies warm on the heavy gray stones. I place my hand upon them and feel the warmth. At the right-hand corner, the green cathedral spire ascends into the pale blue sky of the evening. Between the glowing columns of the cloister is the cool darkness that only churches have, and I stand there and wonder whether when I am 20 I shall have experienced the bewildering emotions of love. The image is alarmingly near. It touches me before it dissolves in the light of the next star shell. I lay hold of my rifle to see that it is in trim. The barrel is wet. I take it in my hands and rub off the moisture with my fingers. Between the meadows behind our town, there stands a line of old poplars by a stream. They were visible from a great distance, and although they grew on one bank only, we called them the Poplar Avenue. Even as children, we had a great love for them. They drew us vaguely thither. We played truant the whole day by them and listened to their rustling. We sat beneath them on the bank of the stream and let our feet hang in the bright, swift waters. The pure fragrance of the water and the melody of the wind in the poplars held our fancies. We loved them dearly. And the image of those days still makes my heart pause in its beating. It is strange that all the memories that come have these two qualities. They are always completely calm, that is predominant in them, and even if they are not really calm, they become so. They are soundless apparitions that speak to me, with looks and gestures, silently, without any word. And it is the alarm of their silence that forces me to lay hold of my sleeve and my rifle, lest I should abandon myself to the liberation and allurement in which my body would dilate and gently pass away into the still forces that lie behind these things. They are quiet in this way, because quietness is so unattainable for us now. At the front there is no quietness, and the curse of the front reaches so far that we never pass beyond it. Even in the remote depots and rest areas, the droning and the muffled noise of shelling is always in our ears. We are never so far off that it is no more to be heard. But these last few days it has been unbearable. Their stillness is the reason why these memories of former times do not awaken desire so much as sorrow. A vast, inapprehensible melancholy. Once we had such desires, but they return not. They are past. They belong to another world that is gone from us. In the barracks they called forth a rebellious, wild craving for their return, for then they were still bound to us. We belonged to them and they to us, even though we were already absent from them. They appeared in the soldiers' songs which we sang as we marched between the glow of the dawn and the black silhouettes of the forests to drill on the moor. They were a powerful remembrance that was in us and came from us. But here in the trenches they are completely lost to us. They arise no more. We are dead and they stand remote on the horizon. They are a mysterious reflection, an apparition that haunts us, that we fear and love without hope. They are strong and our desire is strong, but they are unattainable and we know it. And even if these scenes of our youth were given back to us, we would hardly know what to do. The tender secret influence that passed from them into us could not rise again. We might be amongst them and move in them. We might remember and love them and be stirred by the sight of them. but it would be like gazing at the photograph of a dead comrade. Those are his features, it is his face, and the days we spent together take on a mournful life in the memory. But the man himself it is not. We could never regain the old intimacy with those scenes. It was not any recognition of their beauty and their significance that attracted us, but the communion, the feeling of a comradeship with the things and events of our existence, which cut us off and made the world of our parents a thing incomprehensible to us. For then we surrendered ourselves to events and were lost in them, and the least little thing was enough to carry us down the stream of eternity. Perhaps it was only the privilege of our youth. But as yet we recognized no limits and saw nowhere an end. We had that thrill of expectation in the blood which united us with the course of our days. Today we would pass through the scenes of our youth like travelers. We are burnt up by hard facts. Like tradesmen, we understand distinctions, and like butchers, necessities. We are no longer untroubled. We are indifferent. We might exist there, but should we really live there? We are forlorn like children and experienced like old men. We are crude and sorrowful and superficial. I believe we are lost. My hands grow cold and my flesh creeps, and yet the night is warm. Only the mist is cold, this mysterious mist that trails over the dead and sucks from them their last creeping life. By morning they will be pale and green and their blood congealed and black. Still the parachute rockets shoot up and cast their pitiless light over the stony landscape, which is full of craters and frozen lights like a moon. The blood beneath my skin brings fear and restlessness into my thoughts. They become feeble and tremble. They want warmth and life. They cannot persist without solace, without illusion. They are disordered before the naked picture of despair. I hear the rattle of the mess tins and immediately feel a strong desire for warm food. It would do me good and comfort me. Painfully, I force myself to wait until I am relieved. Then I go into the dugout and find a mug of barley. It is cooked in fat and tastes good. I eat it. Slowly. I remain quiet, though the others are in a better mood, for the shelling has died down. The days go by, and the incredible hours follow one another as a matter of course. Attacks alternate with counterattacks, and slowly the dead pile up in the field of craters between the trenches. We are able to bring in most of the wounded that do not lie too far off, but many have long to wait, and we listen to them dying. For one of them, we search 2 days in vain. He must be lying on his belly and unable to turn over. Otherwise, it is hard to understand why we cannot find him, for it is only when a man has his mouth close to the ground that it is impossible to gauge the direction of his cry. He must have been badly hit. One of those nasty wounds, neither so severe that they exhaust the body at once and a man dreams on in a half swoon, nor so light that a man endures the pain in the hope of becoming well again. Cat thinks he has either a broken pelvis or a shot through the spine. His chest cannot have been injured, otherwise he would not have such strength to cry out. And if it were any other kind of wound, it would be possible to see him moving. He grows gradually hoarser. The voice is so strangely pitched that it seems to be everywhere. The first night some of our fellows go out 3 times to look for him. But when they think they have located him and crawl across, the next time they hear the voice, it seems to come from somewhere else altogether. We search in vain until dawn. We scrutinize the field all day with glasses, but discover nothing. On the second day, the calls are fainter. That will be because his lips and mouth have become dry. Our company commander is promised next turn of leave with 3 days extra to anyone who finds him. This is a powerful inducement, but we would do all that is possible without that, for his cry is terrible. Cat and Crop even go out in the afternoon, and Albert gets the lobe of his ear shot off in consequence. It is to no purpose. I come back without him. It is easy to understand what he cries. At first he called only for help. The second night he must have had some delirium. He talked with his wife and his children. We often detected the name Elise. Today he merely weeps. By evening the voice dwindles to a croaking, but it persists still through the whole night. We hear it so distinctly because the wind blows toward our line. In the morning, when we suppose he must already have long gone to his rest, there comes across to us one last gurgling rattle. The days are hot, and the dead lie unburied. We cannot fetch them all in. If we did, we should not know what to do with them. The shells will bury them. Many have their bellies swollen up like balloons. They hiss, belch, and make movements. The gases in them make noises. The sky is blue and without clouds. In the evening it grows sultry and the heat rises from the earth. When the wind blows toward us, it brings the smell of blood, which is very heavy and sweet. This deathly exhalation from the shell holes seems to be a mixture of chloroform and putrefaction, and fills us with nausea and retching. The nights become quiet, and the hunt for copper driving bands and the silken parachutes of the French star shells begins. Why the driving bands are so desirable, no one knows exactly. The collectors merely assert that they are valuable. Some have collected so many that they will stoop under the weight of them when we go back. But Haya, at least, gives a reason. He intends to give them to his girl to supplement her garters. At this, the Frisians explode with mirth. They slap their knees. By Jove, though, he's a wit, Haya is. He's got brains. Chardin, especially, can hardly contain himself. He takes the largest of the rings in his hand and every now and then puts his legs through it to show how much slack there is. Haya, man, she must have legs like legs, his thoughts mount somewhat higher. And behind, too, she must have, like an elephant. He cannot get over it. I wish I could play hot hand with her once. My hat, Haya beams, proud that his girl should receive so much appreciation. She's a nice bit, he says with self-satisfaction. The parachutes are turned to more practical uses. According to the size of the bust, 3 or perhaps 4 will make a blouse. Crop and I use them as handkerchiefs. The others send them home. If the women could see at what risk these bits of rag are often obtained, they would be horrified. Cat surprises Chardin, endeavoring with perfect equanimity to knock the driving band off a dud. If anyone else had tried it, the thing would have exploded. But Chardin always has his luck with him. One morning, 2 butterflies play in front of our trench. They are brimstone butterflies with red spots on their yellow wings. What can they be looking for here? There is not a plant nor a flower for miles. They settle on the teeth of a skull. The birds, too, are just as carefree. They have long since accustomed themselves to the war. Every morning, larks ascend from no man's land. A year ago, we watched them nesting. The young ones grew up, too. We have a spell from the rats in the trench. They are in no man's land. We know what for. They grow fat. When we see one, we have a crack at it. At night we hear again the rolling behind the enemy lines. All day we have only the normal shelling so that we are able to repair the trenches. There is always plenty of amusement. The airmen see to that. There are countless fights for us to watch every day. Battle planes don't trouble us. But the observation planes we hate like the plague. They put the artillery to us. A few minutes after they appear, shrapnel and high explosives begin to drop on us. We lose 11 men in one day that way, and 5 of them stretcher bearers. 2 are smashed so that Tjaden remarks you could scrape them off the wall of the trench with a spoon and bury them in a mess tin.